Okay, thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and to be able to give this talk. So it's, I think, a bit of a departure from the sorts of things we've been talking about before. So this material, iron phosphate oxide, is an insulator. And what's topological about it, we think, is that it hosts a densely packed state of something like skirmions, but antiferromagnetic skirmions. And so I'm going to first explain this concept of partial helical order, which some of you may have heard about in the context of manganese silicide. I'm going to explain what this means and what the experimental signatures are. I'll introduce this compound, iron phosphate oxide, which we've been working on for about 5 years now, but I don't think many people have really picked up on it yet. I'll explain sort of how we started to understand the neutron scattering results from this material. And our more recent work is on single crystals, and we found evidence for antiferromagnetic partial helical order. And then I'll show you some of our evidence that we have that this might actually be a disordered antiferromagnetic skirmion-like state. So really basic, starting at the beginning, what is helical order? Well, the idea is that you can have a sort of spiral spin structure where if this is the lattice spacing A, the spin structure repeats over a length scale which is much longer than that lattice spacing, and it can be incommensurate, so it doesn't have to be an integer multiple of A. And how you get such a state, you can get it a lot of different ways, usually through competing interactions. So a really famous way of getting it is with ferromagnetism and Jalashinsky-Maria interactions competing. That's the case for the B20 compounds like manganese silicide. Or, you know, another way you could get it is through antiferromagnetic Heisenberg interactions if you have a first and second nearest neighbor interaction. So that both of these can lead to this kind of pitch, this sort of spiral spin structure. So how, if you're a neutron scatterer as I am, you think automatically, what does this look like in neutron scattering or diffraction more generally? So if we look at just a real space picture here of a ferromagnet, what you'd see in neutron scattering is you would see a series of Bragg peaks that lie, magnetic Bragg peaks, which lie on top of nuclear Bragg peaks. And that is what I would call the parent structure for this incommensurate helical state. And in the case of the incommensurate helical state, what you see is satellite Bragg peaks, which are split off from the zone centers of the commensurate parent structure, which in this case would be like the nuclear Bragg peaks. So this is very familiar to most of us, that you would see these satellite Bragg peaks. So really famous examples, the B20 compounds, like manganese silicide, iron cobalt silicide, and others. These exhibit helical order as you cool down to about 30 Kelvin. And the reason for the helical order in this case, in these cases, is from the ferromagnetism plus DM interactions. And if you look at the helices, they are locally ferromagnetic. So if you were to look at just a small number of spins, they would look like they're almost aligned. Okay, this is in contrast to what I'm going to show you later, where we have locally antiferromagnetic helices. And what's generated a lot of interest in these compounds, of course, is that you can apply a small magnetic field and you can form a skirmion lattice. What's a skirmion? Well, it's an object like this, which is a topologically protected object. It's really a spin texture. You can see the spins are kind of winding around in several directions. And it usually has this kind of cylindrical shape. So in these compounds, the B20 compounds, a lot of really nice work has been done using Lorentz TEM, transmission electron microscopy, where, for instance, this is a paper from Takura's group on iron cobalt silicide, where they see in zero field below 25 Kelvin, they see evidence for just a regular helical structure. And how that shows up in this image is the light parts here are like the crest of the wave, if you will, and then the dark parts are like the trough of the wave. So this is like spins pointing up and the dark part is spins pointing down. And you can see that the helix kind of propagates along this direction, if you think about it like that. If you look at the diffraction, which in this case is just a fast Fourier transform of this image, That shows up as two satellite Bragg peaks, which are oriented along the direction of the helix. Now, in these materials, you can apply a small magnetic field near the phase transition, and you end up forming a skirmion lattice, and now this looks like a bunch of these sort of circular objects that have formed a close-packed hexagonal structure. And how that shows up in diffraction is six satellite Bragg peaks. And one thing I want to point out is that they have the same distance from the origin, and that's because the distance between the skirmions is the helical pitch length in the parent structure. Okay, so this is what you'd expect for a skirmion lattice. Now, in manganese silicide, it's been known for some time now that there is an unusual phase that can be produced, which is called a partially ordered helical state. And how this is achieved is if you apply pressure to this material, there is a first-order phase transition at about 14 kilobar to a non-Fermi liquid state. But importantly for this talk, at least, the signatures in neutron scattering go from having Bragg peaks that are associated with the skirmion structure to, or sorry, the helical structure, to a spherical shell of scattering. Okay, so we don't have Bragg peaks, they don't have Bragg peaks anymore, but they have a shell. And this has not only been observed at above this critical pressure, but it's also been observed in the temperature range above the ordering transition as correlations are starting to form. And this is an example of small angle neutron scattering. You can see evidence for this spherical shell. This is above TC and this is below TC. They have the Bragg spots instead. So what could be responsible for the spherical shell of scattering? There's several ways that you can imagine this sort of thing coming about. First of all, it's clear that in the limit where the spherical shell is just uniformly intense, that it means that there's no preferred direction for the helical ordering wave vector. Okay, but you still have some kind of incommensurate order because it's a shell and not just some like sphere that's filled in. Okay. So there's several ways to imagine this. You could imagine just having helices, but different parts of the sample choose different directions. So that's what I call helical domains. And then you might ask the question, like, what happens at the intersection between these? Like, what's a helical domain wall look like? That might be an interesting question. Then a second idea that you can imagine is that actually this helical order kind of winds around. It doesn't form different separate domains necessarily, but it does sort of meander through space. And then perhaps one of the most interesting scenarios you can imagine is that similar to the skirmion lattice, you have a bunch of skirmions which are separated by some distance on average, which is about what you would get for the skirmion lattice state, but they don't form a translationally symmetry broken state. So this was actually what was first proposed for manganese silicide in the partially ordered state. But it doesn't necessarily have to be skirmions. So later on, there was a lot of talk about the blue phase of manganese silicide, which is very similar to a disordered skirmion state, but it's not quite the same thing. So there are these, what they call in this paper by Dmitry Resnik's group, triple twist cylinders, which are similar to skirmions, but not exactly the same. And the whole terminology here, blue phase, is based on liquid crystal states where you have the sort of the directors of the molecular liquid crystal state are sort of winding around these directions here, and those can be close-packed but not ordered. So this is just to show that, you know, people have imagined other things other than disordered skirmions for this type of state. And this one here was supported by some extensive Monte Carlo simulations. I think it's a bit of a misnomer, but in the liquid crystal case, some of the blue phases are blue, like visually blue, but they actually take on a range of colors. So I think people regretted calling them that later. But, yes. Right. Yeah, so just going back one step here. So going to an ordered skirmion lattice, you have the distance between the skirmions is equal to the pitch length of the helix. Now, if you imagine that you have like more of a liquid of these things, the average distance would be approximately what you would get for the ordered state, but you don't break that translational symmetry. So in that case, you would expect that you would actually get a little bit of a broadening of your spherical shell because it's not going to be exactly lambda. Okay. So now that brings me to our material, iron phosphate oxide. And we've written three papers on it now, starting in 2015. Our latest one just appeared on the archive today, so you can go check that out. It's not a coincidence that it got posted today. So let me just start by introducing this compound, because I think most people probably haven't seen the structure before, and it's not a simple structure. Okay, so, but it is possible to understand it. So the magnetism here is based on iron 3+. And iron is within a trigonal bipyramid, and these kind of form these triangular units. Okay, and this is a phosphate group down here. When you put them into a lattice, what you find is if you just focus on the iron atoms, you get these triangles, and those are connected by the red bonds, which are first nearest neighbor bonds. And then the blue bonds here connect between triangles, so the red things are the triangle, and then the blue ones go between. And this is not a planar structure, so it's not like a triangles of triangles lattice. It's actually fully three-dimensional, and that's represented by the different colors here. So purple is like the lowest height if coming out of the board here, and then it goes to the green one and then the orange one. So I think personally, when I visualize the lattice, the easiest way to do it for me is to take note that this is a rhombohedral lattice. It's R3M, which is actually non-centrosymmetric, and I'll come back to that in a second. But that means that actually these triangular units are decorating the corners of a rhombohedron, which is just a cube that's been kind of compressed along the body diagonal. And so that's how I like to think about it. It's really a three-dimensional structure with these triangles decorating the corner of this rhombohedron. So don't be confused and think that this is a two-dimensional structure, even though a lot of what I'm going to be talking about, it almost looks like it's going to be two-dimensional. So we found over the years that this simple model, Heisenberg model of J1, J2, seems to reproduce a lot of the magnetic properties that we have found. But we know it can't be the only part of the story because, as I said, this is non-centrosymmetric, so there should be a Jalachinsky-Maria interaction on all bonds. And so that's one of the questions that we have remaining is how does that come in? But for the purposes of our discussion today, I'm going to focus on this Heisenberg model here. Oh, and one more thing. This is a very well-insulating sample. Okay, so this rules out some techniques for trying to understand whether we really have skirmions. So, okay, so what does this thing do? Well, if you cool it down, you get a transition at 163 Kelvin. This has actually been known for decades. I think the first study of this was the year that I was born, back in the 80s. So this compound is really, really old, and we kind of picked it up again after several decades. And now with modern neutron instrumentation, we're able to learn a lot more about it than what was known previously. So there's a transition at 163 Kelvin, which was previously identified as being an antiferromagnet. This is the key capacity, and this is the susceptibility as a function of temperature. So you can see it looks like an antiferromagnet because it's decreasing as you go below Tn. It's a very highly frustrated material. We know this because we can look at the Curie-Weiss behavior, and the Curie-Weiss temperature can't actually even be extracted because it's not linear up to 1,000 Kelvin. So we know that the Curie-Weiss temperature is higher than 1,000 Kelvin, or 900 Kelvin, and that makes a frustration index of at least 5.5. And based on this, we can put a lower bound on the nearest neighbor interaction of 300 Kelvin. So it has very strong magnetic interactions and is highly frustrated. So the first thing we did was neutron powder diffraction because growing crystals of this compound is really challenging. And when I first saw this pattern, I was like, well, I've never seen anything like that before. I actually went to all my colleagues at the NIST Center for Neutron Research and asked them, have you ever seen anything like this before? What is this? And nobody knew. So it seems to be a pretty unique signature. And what's unique about it is that you have these very broad, flat peaks that show up. And in addition to that, there is a magnetic peak, which is very, very sharp. So this second really tall, sharp peak is magnetic, and so are these broad, flat-topped things. It took a long time to understand what this could be for me. It was sort of the first time I'd seen anything like this. And what we ended up doing is modeling it as a helical structure, an antiferromagnetic helical structure, which has a pitch length of about 86 angstroms, and the ordering wave vector direction is somewhere in the hexagonal AB plane. So I told you it's a rhombohedral cell. We discuss it usually in terms of the hexagonal setting of that cell. And so in the AB plane, we have some incommensuration. And that would lead to six symmetry-related K vectors, and you get, therefore, six peaks underneath this broad thing. Just take a look at the structure for a second. It looks a lot like manganese silicide or those other B20 compounds at first glance. But what we're looking at here is we're looking edge-on onto the triangles. So these little gray bars are actually the edges of the triangles. And as you go up along the C-axis, you see that these flip sign. So this one's pointing down, this one's going up, this one's going down. And then the next unit cell up is completely reversed. So this is a fully compensated antiferromagnet. So this is what we would call antiferromagnetic helical order. But that's not the only story, a part of the story. So it turns out we wanted to figure out, like, can we see these peaks if we get better resolution? So we went to this instrument, PowGen, at the Spallation Neutron Source, which had a factor of, I think, 8 better resolution than the previous data. And we saw that we still could not resolve those peaks inside that broad feature. Not only that, if we take just this model of the antiferromagnetic structure and apply it without doing anything else, we would get this blue line, which is, you would clearly be able to resolve that if you using this instrument. But we found that we cannot resolve those peaks, and we actually needed to apply broadening to these peaks in order to match the peak shape here. We had to apply so much broadening that it implies a correlation length in the AB plane of about 10 nanometers. So you can think about like a domain of about 20 nanometers in diameter. And along the C-axis, it's like perfectly correlated, and that's reflected in this peak here. Okay, so that's like a resolution-limited peak that is only probing the C-axis correlations. So we found out that we needed finite size broadening in the AB plane, and this implies needle-like domains. So just an aside, when we were fitting the powder data, we realized that there is actually a circle of best fits. So looking at this, it looks like an oval, but that's because I've plotted delta A and delta B, which are the two components of the incommensuration AB plane, as if those two directions are perpendicular, which they're not. So this is how it actually looks. They're 60 degrees apart. And when you plot them at 90 degrees, it looks like an oval. Okay, so this is a circle. And so basically anywhere along this ring would have been a fine fit for the data. So already from the powder data, it was somewhat suspicious that this could be actually a circle of scattering and not just like one incommensurate wave vector and its symmetry-related pairs. So what we did is we tried to model this as if it was a circle and did like in a poor man's way and actually just took a bunch of these choices and added them together and wanted to see if that could explain our pattern. So it turns out that it does a pretty good job in some ways. That's this blue line here. You can see it fills in the breadth of this thing, but it still doesn't match the edges of that feature. So the blue line is without any broadening, and the orange line is with broadening. So even when you pick a circle for this structure factor, you still need to apply the same in-plane broadening of about 10 nanometers.
And that's not resolution limited.
Correct. So the resolution limited would be this blue line. So an important thing to keep an eye on is the slope of this edge, okay? Because that tells us about the correlation length. So we wanted to explore this more, and this was really the idea of Jamie Nielsen at Colorado State University, who's been collaborating with me on this project. He said, well, what happens if we take out iron and replace it with something non-magnetic, in this case, gallium? And it turns out that you get the same kind of magnetic structure. So here are the different X compositions with increasing gallium. And the width of the peak increases, which means that the helical pitch length is decreasing. And the slopes of the edges also get a lot shallower. So that implies, if you do all the fitting, that you have a pitch length which is decreasing as a function of X, and you have a correlation length which is decreasing as a function of X at the same rate. And not only that, they're the same number, right? So the pitch length and the correlation length seem to be intrinsically linked together. And that seems very strange. So what would cause this, whatever this structure is, to just terminate after one pitch length? That seems very strange. So fortunately, Jamie was really interested in continuing this project, and he had his student Michael Tarney grow single crystals. But they were never able to get them larger than about 300 microns, which for a neutron scatter is just terrible. It's like the worst. However, the moment is very large. It's about 4.5 Bohr magnetons. So we thought, oh, why not? We'll try to do some diffraction experiments. So we reached out to Huibo Chow at the HB3A four-circle diffractometer at Heifer, and he was enthusiastic to try this. So we went ahead and did it, and you can see here, this is a little aluminum pin that's like the size of my finger or smaller, and that little black spot there is the crystal. So for those of you who have seen any other pictures of neutron scattering crystals, this should impress you, because usually the crystal is the size of your finger, okay? So this is, trust me, this is very hard. But the way that we made it work was we had this really great instrument which had a doubly focusing monochromator. The downside of this monochromator is that because it's focusing the neutrons at the sample, it also creates a divergence on the other side, which smears out any peaks that you see in the vertical direction. And we have a 2D detector as well, so that enables us to see that peak shape really clearly. So we had to take this resolution into account when we were looking at our data. And that's where my graduate student Colin Sarkis really shone on this project. He dug into the old literature. This is a paper from 1966 talking about resolution, well, talking about four-circle diffractometers, and he used this paper to basically calculate the rotation of the resolution ellipsoid for each of the peaks that we measured. So here's an example of a nuclear reflection. So this is just would be a delta function without the resolution, and then he convolved it with a resolution ellipsoid, and this just shows that, you know, you can get the right orientation using this formalism here. Okay, so that's important. And usually on HB3A, the instrument we use, this is all people look at, is just delta functions. But in our case, we see rings. Okay, so this, as foreshadowed by the powder diffraction data, actually our structure factor is a ring and not a set of Bragg peaks. So here's the unconvolved ring looked at in the HK plane. This time we actually used a perpendicular vector, K prime. So it really is a ring. And then looking at the HL plane, we see it edge on. And so those are just the two spots that come from intersecting that ring. Here's our data and in those two planes. And here's the simulation of this ring convolved with the resolution function. So this clearly shows that it is a ring, and also we can match the intensity profile using this technique as well. So it turns out that all of our data is resolution limited because the resolution of this instrument wasn't extremely fine. So we can't say anything more about the broadening. We have to go based on the powder data for that. But at least this shows us that we do not have Bragg peaks. We have a ring of scattering. And furthermore, this ring onsets at the right temperature. This is what would be considered to be like an order parameter for this state, just the integrated ring intensity as a function of temperature.
Is it the crystal without gallium?
Yes. This is the pure. We have not actually done any single crystal on the gallium dope samples. So there's probably no reason to show this except it's beautiful, and And I think it does show that Collins' calculation is reliable. So these are all different rings, different zone centers, and his simulation can reproduce the patterns that we see. Here, if you look closely, you can see there's some feature in the middle that's actually lambda by 2 higher order contamination from a Bragg peak, so not to be expected to be reproduced. So we wanted to understand why we have a ring of scattering in this material. So we went to my theory colleague, Marty Gelfand at Colorado State University, and we employed the help of this brilliant undergraduate who later went on to work at Google. So we lost him, unfortunately. But the two of them together, they worked on the Lenger-Tesa model, which should give the ground state in this classical Heisenberg model, so long as the spins satisfy the hard constraint, where all the spins are the same length. So they did this, and they found that they could find a ground state that satisfies the hard constraint and their helices. And then they looked at what the ordering wave vector is, what the energy of each ordering wave vector in this ring is. And what they found is that there is a small variation as you go around in the AB plane in terms of the energy. So the lowest points here would actually be the preferred ground state configurations. But if you look at what that energy scale is, it amounts to about 400 millikelvin compared to the interaction strength of 300 Kelvin. So this is, for all intents and purposes, this is a degenerate ring of wave vectors. And again, this is just within the Heisenberg model. It does not have DM interactions included. So with that, you know, we take a step back and think, what do we have here? So I told you that we have needle-like domains. So we have this correlation volume that looks like a tube coming up along the c-axis. And this is some kind of anti-ferromagnetic incommensurate order. We now know that this is a partial order. So similar to manganese silicide, our structure factor is not Bragg peaks, but it is a continuous ring of scattering. In manganese silicide, it's a spherical shell. Here, it's a ring in the AB plane. And we've been able to show that this is at least consistent with a J1-J2 frustrated Heisenberg model. But the thing that I think is really still quite interesting and I think points towards one of the scenarios I mentioned before for partial order is that the correlation length in the AB plane, so this width here of this needle volume, it tracks the helical pitch length and it's equal to it. So this is a really strange result, I think. And it kind of brings me back to this idea of having disordered skirmions. So here I just stole this picture from a paper that I'm not involved with at all. In fact, this is a completely different lattice. This is a square lattice, J1, J2, J3, under an applied field. But what they show in this this paper is that there's some skirmion liquid part of the phase diagram. It's not a phase so much as it is the correlations developing before the transition. What I like about this is you can kind of see how, at least in simulations, you would have, this is a skirmion lattice and it leads to these 6 Bragg peaks. And in the skirmion liquid, you get this sort of spherical shell or a circular structure factor. So why I think this is interesting is that the skirmion-skirmion distance is the same as in the skirmion lattice phase. So the distance between these things is about the same as this. And it's set by the helical pitch length. And so that brings us back to this plot here of the gallium doping, where we see that the correlation length and the pitch length are intimately connected, as they would be for this type of state as well. So just one more point here, which is that in our case, if we had this disordered skirmion state, these would be anti-ferromagnetic skirmions, because we have a locally anti-ferromagnetic helical structure. And these have been proposed theoretically to be quite interesting. I didn't mention it before, but skirmions are a candidate for magnetic information storage, so like some kind of racetrack memory storage. And one of the problems with them is that for the locally ferromagnetic ones, they have something called the Magnus force, or the skirmion Hall effect, which when you try to push them along with, say, a current, they actually like wander off to the side of the sample. With an antiferromagnetic case, it was shown in 2016 that you would end up canceling that out between the two sublizes, and so you get a straight motion for the antiferromagnetic skirmion. So that was of interest. But for a long time, there was no example experimentally until recently, just this year, there was a report of a bilayer skirmion made in an synthetic antiferromagnet, which looks something like this, where you have like a regular skirmion, and then the next layer up, you have the reverse of that. So in our case, in iron phosphate oxide, we would have something similar to this, except it would go on forever in the C-axis. So open questions, we have lots. So, you know, if we have a state like this, or, you know, it doesn't even have to be skirmions, maybe it's something like an antiferromagnetic blue phase, but how would that be stabilized? So right now we just have a Heisenberg model. It doesn't seem likely that that would produce these types of topological defects on its own. I'll remind you that this is all zero field, so it's not even like you apply a field or you apply pressure or anything like that. So it would have to be in zero field that they get stabilized. But also, like, why wouldn't they crystallize? That's the other question. What role does the quasi-degeneracy of the Heisenberg model play? Because we know that we do have that from the Lunger-Tisa calculations. And what happens when you include the Jaluzinski-Maria interactions? And then I think one of the most important questions is, how could we possibly see the spin structure in real space or gain additional evidence for the topological nature? You know, you might want to do Lorentz TM or something like that, but unfortunately, because this is a perfectly compensated antiferromagnet, this is not likely to work. And then finally, what are the dynamics of this phase? So can we manipulate, first of all, like, what are the just basic equilibrium dynamics? So we're interested in studying the inelastic spectrum from neutron scattering, but also, can it be manipulated? So can you apply thermal gradients? Can you apply electric fields to try to move these things around? So these are open questions. And with that, I would like to thank my collaborators, especially my graduate student, Colin Starkus, who's really worked very hard on this single crystal data, Michael Tarney, who grew the crystals, Ethan Coldren, who did the Lunger-Tisa calculations, and Jamie Nielsen, who basically came up with this whole project and let me work on it. So with that, I'd be happy to take your questions. Yes, so five halves, yeah. Yeah. Right, so if it's there, it would probably be a perturbation on top of the Heisenberg model. I mean, it should be there because it's allowed by symmetry, but yeah. Yes, but maybe even just a small amount of DM interactions could explain some of what we're seeing. Yeah.
Kate, I'd like to think back about the structure of the ring that you see in the reciprocal space.
Yes.
So if you imagine that this is a bunch of domains and this is basically, a quasi-local Bragg peak, so quasi-pointed Bragg peaks that are just assembled, that's one version that you pointed out. If you imagine that you do have a truly uniform or truly isotropic ring in K-space, right? That reminds me of the model of Brazovsky from years gone by, where you consider condensation of bosons in a case where they condense not at a given Q vector, but in a ring with a fixed diameter or fixed radius in K space.
Okay.
Now, of course, here you have what looks like a hexagonal symmetry, and so probably that ring will instead split into six points that are brighter. And that seemed to be the case in one of your simulations.
Yes, that was in the Lunger-Tisa calculation. We saw actually 6 points that were actually the lowest energy configurations.
So I guess my question is, so how do you think of it? Do you think of it as a truly rotationally invariant structure in K-space, or do you think of it as a six-fold rotation symmetry because you have C6 axis in your crystal?
I think it's not, like, that question is about energy scales, because at least in the Lunger-Tisa calculation, the differences between, like, those lowest K-vectors and the rest of the ring is so small, it's like a thousandth of the interaction strength. So, like, of course, in a real lattice, like, you have some anisotropy, and you can't really get away from that. But the question is, like, for all of the properties that we measure, does that really matter? And it seems like it doesn't in this case. Whether that's because we haven't gotten cold enough, we're measuring at 4 Kelvin, those energy differences are like 400 millikelvin, or maybe it's kinetically prohibited from actually finding that minimum energy. Yes.
I guess I missed the argument for the absence of other anisotropies.
Other, what do you mean, other anisotropies?
So you only mentioned Zalesinski Maria.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. No, I haven't considered the full anisotropic interactions. That's true. Yeah.
And maybe the even the pure system must have some degree of local structural disorder, and even small structural distortions can, in principle, in the non-collinear magnets, can create sort of extended features, which may also contribute to your smearing that you see.
I see, yeah. Yeah, it could be something like that. We did actually look with neutron pair distribution function analysis at the local structure. Because we were seeing so much disorder, we thought maybe. But we couldn't resolve anything that wasn't just the perfectly ordered structure in that case. But it doesn't mean that it's not there. Yeah.
Nice talk. Do you have some understanding of what the sort of the parent structure is? I mean, if the in-plane Q was really zero, what would it look like?
Yes.
I get confused with the triangles.
Yes. What it would look like is just take these two cells here. It would look like these are perfectly on the triangles, which are these little, sorry, I should probably point with the pointer. These little gray edges are like the edge of the triangle.
Yeah.
So it would look like you have ferromagnetic triangles.
Oh, and ferromagnetic triangle.
Yes, okay. And then the next triangle up would be flipped, and then the next triangle would be flipped again, and just repeating that along the c-axis.
So is the, in the modeling, is the J1 is kind of the inside the triangle, is that ferromagnetic?
It's anti-ferromagnetic, but it turns out that J2 dominates because there's more J2 neighbors than there are J1. And also from some super exchange arguments, you can also show, and this was done back in the 80s, that J2 should be stronger than J1. So it's both that J2 by itself is stronger and there's more neighbors for the J2. But they're both anti-ferromagnetic.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
All three bonds are ferromagnetic?
They're all anti-ferromagnetic, but because J2, yeah.
Spins are parallel, all three spins in the triangle.
Yes, all three spins are parallel. So it's almost like you could think about this unit as being one spin in a way, I guess. But it's not really. I mean, they're three separate spins. So.
Related to the Andrew's question about the weak crystallization of Brazovsky, so you can have, if you have a, like, you know, soft mode living on a sphere or ring, you can have a fluctuation-induced first-order transition. And you might have the same if all the parameter is multi-component, but it has to be number of it has to be larger than some critical value. I don't remember exactly, but it seems that you have a second order transition, right?
It looks so, like it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe very weakly first order.
Yes, yeah. Right. It is at least from what we can tell from making. Let's see if it comes up. There. So yeah. Oh, come on now. Back.
One before.
Yes. So here we track the intensity as a function of temperature. And it does look like a continuous transition, not first order, but it's hard to rule out weakly first order. Yeah. And also the heat capacity, I mean, it's actually kind of weird looking. It actually has a pretty sharp peak for being at such a high temperature. So maybe that's some argument for it being somewhat first order, but yeah. Of course, we can't really analyze like the critical exponents when it's this high of temperature. It's hard to do that. Yeah.
Okay, so it's time to speak again.